Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama declared his plans for a troop drawdown from Afghanistan.
Starting next month, we will be able to remove 10,000 of our troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year. And we will bring home a total of 33,000 troops by next summer.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor quits talks on the budget and debt ceiling after Democrats push to raise taxes. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
I understand his frustration. I understand why he did what he did. But I think those talks could continue if they're willing to take the tax hikes off the table.
And mobster Whitey Bulger is caught in Santa Monica, California, after 16 years on the lam. Here's Richard Delorier from the FBI's Boston Division.
We have captured one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, a man notorious in Boston and around the world for very serious crimes he is alleged to have committed.
This hour on Point, these headlines and more on our weekly news roundtable with William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, On Point's Jack Beatty, and we hope to be joined shortly by Jonathan Martin of Politico. You can join the conversation at any time. What's your reaction to the president's troop drawdown plan, to the talks on the debt ceiling collapsing? Joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is William McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
We are joined now from Washington by Jonathan Martin, senior political reporter for Politico. Jonathan, welcome back.
I was here all along. Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, who's been here all along from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Bob, Bill, and Jonathan.
Let's start with Afghanistan. On Wednesday, President Obama laid out his plans for the drawing down of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan starting this summer. Speaking from the White House, he outlined his vision for what he called a responsible end to the war in Afghanistan.
The goal that we seek is achievable and can be expressed simply. No safe haven from which al-Qaeda or its affiliates can launch attacks against our homeland or our allies. We won't try to make Afghanistan a perfect place. We will not police its streets or patrol its mountains indefinitely. That is the responsibility of the Afghan government, which must step up its ability to protect its people and move from an economy shaped by war to one that can sustain a lasting peace.
Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the House Armed Services Committee yesterday that troop withdrawal is risky, but he says he supports the president's plan.
The president's decisions are more aggressive and incur more risk than I was originally prepared to accept. More force for more time is, without doubt, the safer course. But that does not necessarily make it the best course. Only the president, in the end, can really determine the acceptable level of risk we must take. I believe he has done so.
And General David Petraeus reiterated this message yesterday to the Senate Intelligence Committee during his confirmation hearings for the CIA director position. Jonathan, let's start with you. What's the buzz in Washington? Was it a political speech or a strategic speech?
Oh, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, the skepticism from the right was immediate as to why President Obama announced that the drawdown would be taking place before the 2012 elections rather than after 2012 and happening in early 2013. I mean, obviously, the assumption on the right is that President Obama is playing to his liberal base. It's interesting, though, because this is an issue where increasingly the lines are not drawn, however, strictly on a partisan basis. You know, in the Bush era, it was pretty predictable as to who was going to take what position when it came to foreign policy in the wars. Now it's a little bit murkier because you've got Republicans who are not interventionists and who have apparently found their voice with a Democrat in the White House, who I think are also influenced by war-weary constituents who are concerned about this decade-long conflict. And then you've got Democrats who are divided between those who are loyal to the president and more internationalist in their outlook, and those that hail from the dovish wing of the party. So there's some really fascinating coalitions, some unlikely coalitions here taking place who are for hastening the withdrawal and those who want to stay the course.
Bill McKenzie, what did you hear in the president's message?
Well, you know, at first I thought it was more of a military speech. And the more I kind of read between the lines, I think it was more of a political speech. If you listen to what Admiral Mullen say and General Petraeus, I think if you read between the lines there that the internal debates within the administration were with the military commander saying something different from what the president eventually concluded. And that's important because the military commanders, obviously the ones who are on the field, they know what is happening there. And if they're advising that the president that perhaps we don't need this particular timetable, then that leads me to think that this speech was a little bit more political than I originally thought. Others have pointed out this is new, that the last of the drawdown of the surge troops will come 2 months before the November 12th presidential election. So, you know, I think there was a larger element than I first thought, that the president was trying to appeal to his political base. I guess the question going forward is, will the remaining 68,000 troops be able to secure and stabilize Afghanistan along with the Afghan forces themselves after we're over with? And we all have a lot riding on the answer being yes. And
Jack Beatty, a shorter run than that. Did the president make his case? Do you think that he'll be able to accomplish the goal of getting the surge troops out next year?
He may well. He has a political imperative, as our two other speakers said. But, you know, the speech, really, it attained that elevation from reality that a Financial Times writer felicitously termed the higher guff. It's Lincolnian rhythms. You know, they were really at variance with the political agenda to remove Afghanistan as an election issue. 70,000 troops are going to remain there after 2012. Why? You know, a Taliban leader has said that the Americans have the watches, we have the time. If the Taliban has waited 10 years for us to leave, why can't they wait until 2014 when the transition the president talks about to the pathetic Afghan security forces will be completed? The president didn't answer that question. He did not address the contradiction between killing the Taliban and making peace with them. He said nothing about the contradiction of Pakistan, that we're sending billions to a sham government behind which is a deep state that is at war with us. You know, a policy so divided against itself, to paraphrase Lincoln, cannot stand.
Beth is on the line from Schenectady, New York. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I understand there's going to be more troops over there than after this quote-unquote drawdown, this nicety for, you know, a bloodbath. There's going to be more troops over there than when Bush was in office. And the only people he's trying to appeal to are the financial cronies. His speech said nothing. It was meaningless. And as I said, it's time to abolish the two-party system because there's so much money tied into it that someone can sit up there and try to make it sound like, oh, he's really doing what he said he was going to do when he was getting elected. Not to appease anybody that voted for him or me, to appease his financial backers and those that owe him something. It's an outrage what he said on Wednesday night. And there also needs to be more footage coming out of that country so people really know what war looks like.
So, Beth, let me ask you this question. What's your guess on how long U.S. troops, maybe some of your neighbors, will be there?
Well, I have a feeling we have people all over the world. There could still be people there, I would say, that we don't know about in 10 years. But that my point, and that's horrible for them, but there needs to be some, I think if there were some footage out of the country so Americans knew what war really looked like, I think that would be one of the most appealing things and the quickest way to bring pressure to bear so we wouldn't get these phony speeches anymore.
Beth, thank you very much. Jonathan Martin, let me ask you this question. A lot of questions about whether pulling out the surge troops will leave Afghanistan vulnerable to the Taliban. What's your view on that?
Well, first, let me just address the caller. I am heartily ignorant of the influence of money in politics, and I think that certainly when it comes to issues like Wall Street regulation, like taxes, like earmarks, the patterns are pretty clear. I'm though not sure that this has much to do with the president's quote unquote financial cronies. I think it is. One of those issues that has more to do with the national security and national interest than anything else. As far as the impact of the Taliban in Afghanistan, I mean, the doves say that, look, there are less than 100 al-Qaeda actually left in the country, that we went to war to try to address those that were behind the attacks of 9/11, and that there are simply not a lot of those individuals left there in the country. So why are we still there?
William McKenzie, are Afghan forces ready, do you think, to take over?
Well, I haven't been there, so I haven't interviewed them, and I don't know it in a firsthand way. But from what you read and hear and talking to others who have been there and follow the situation closely, no, they are not quite ready to do that. And I think it's only natural. It's going to take a bit of time for them to step up and be able to do that. And I think to the president's credit, you know, his Afghan surge has been making and showing progress. It's just we haven't had enough progress to be able to get to the point where we're ready to hand over even more of this to Afghan fighting forces. And, you know, I think we go back to the point of why are we there? And obviously we're all war weary, but we remember why we're there, and we need to keep that point in mind. It's all about making sure Afghanistan is not a haven for terrorists.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this week in the news. We're joined today by Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, and Jonathan Martin of Politico, and Jack Beatty is here, too. Let's stick with Afghanistan for a couple of minutes. Tim Pawlenty, former Minnesota governor, now a 2012 presidential candidate, found the president's troop withdrawal speech this week to be deeply concerning, he said. He thought the president's goal of ending the war responsibly was weak.
When America goes to war, America needs to win. We need to close out the war successfully. And what that means now is not nation building. What it means is to follow General Petraeus's advice and to get those security forces built up to the point where they can pick up the slack as we draw down.
Jack Beatty, talk about the Republican response to the troop withdrawal plan. Any surprises in what you heard this week?
Some surprises. Jonathan, I think, could speak to this better. But from the debate last week, I got the strong impression that the Republicans were, you know, not really going to make much of an issue out of the drawdown, that they had read the tea leaves. They had seen that a majority now, for the first time, favors withdrawal from Afghanistan as soon as possible. And they were also cognizant of the budgetary reality. So they weren't going to make it a big issue. Pawlenty, however, seemed an exception on the stage, and now I hear from Mitt Romney, he sounds like he's something of an exception. Jonathan, can you straighten this out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you've got in the Republican field is a reflection of a party that, while more hawkish in recent years, is careful about positioning themselves to be too pro-war at a time when a large swath of voters are frankly exhausted with America's involvement overseas. It's been really fascinating to me, though, to watch Romney, especially, you know, on that debate stage. He sounded a real skeptical note when it came to Afghanistan. I think he's been much more cautious recently and has sort of walked that back because on the right, you know, there is a very strong force in the Republican Party that is interventionist. And you saw Lindsey Graham and John McCain, the two senators and famous friends who are hardcore hawks, who really went after Romney for selling him that skeptical note. And you've got Tim Pawlenty, as he showed, or as he played in that bite, who is trying to sort of play for that hawkish segment of the party, with Romney and a John Huntsman sounding more skeptical notes about U.S. intervention abroad. Pawlenty now wants to be the super hawk because he thinks that's where the political space is, and that's also where the financial space is among donors.
All right, let's talk to On Point listeners about all of this. Amanda is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Amanda. You're on Point.
Hi, Bob. My point was simply that the longer we're there, that we just delay the Afghans' decision. The Afghans have to decide for themselves whether they're going to fight the Taliban and whether they're going to, not be a country of, haven for terrorists, or they're going to let things roll and let the Americans, spend their money, spend their time, and do their work, for them. So I think that, at whatever endpoint we decide, at some point the Afghans have to take over and they have to decide what they're going to do. And the longer we're over there, we just delay that time for them.
So, Amanda, you sound like you're skeptical that there will ever be an endpoint, or at least not an endpoint soon.
Well, I think that there's two things. One is that, we're still seen by a lot of Afghans as an invading force, much like the Soviets were, when they were over there. And we, as long as we're over there, to some Afghans, that just breeds more terrorists who don't want us there. And I think the second point is that, it's not clear to me that the Afghans are 100%, against the effort against the Taliban. I mean, look how many Afghan security forces have been involved in suicide attacks that killed our own men.
Jack Beatty, are we stuck? Will we get out in the short run, or will it be a very long run?
Well, I think Amanda showed more strategic sagacity in her remarks there than the president has. She put her finger right on this issue of dependency, which I think argues that whenever it happens, this force may not be ready because it has not been tested. Bing West, the military analyst who's been over there, who's written a book about this, he says that's the central problem. We have been for 10 years doing for this quote-unquote military what, if they really wanted to save their country, they'd be doing for themselves. And the issue of training, that's a kind of bagatelle. The real issue is morale. Do you fight for your country or do you not? The fact is, as someone who's been over there told me recently, says it isn't a country. It's a series, it's a congeries of districts and tribes that's never been a country. And so people don't feel any fealty to it. And I think that Amanda also puts her finger right on it. Our footprint is so big that we are funding the Taliban. This comes out again and again. I mean, the ripoffs on construction sites, the fellows who wander in from the hills with a gun and they say, "I'm a Taliban, I'm surrendering, give me a few thousand dollars," and we hand them the money. We're paying for the opposition. Boy, you talk about something that keeps a war going.
All right, we've brushed up on 2012 politics in relation to the Afghanistan issue and the troop drawdown. Let's talk about it directly now. John Huntsman, until recently the U.S. ambassador to China for President Obama, announced his candidacy for the GOP presidential nomination in New Jersey on Tuesday and promised to run a civil campaign.
I respect the President of the United States. He and I have a difference of opinion on how to help a country we both love. But the question each of us wants the voters to answer is who will be the better president, not who's the better American.
Well, and we're still wondering after that whether Texas Governor Rick Perry will be a candidate for president, a candidate for the GOP nomination, though he hasn't declared. He's been making appearances at events like the Republican Leadership Conference in New Orleans last Saturday.
This administration clearly believes that government is not only the answer to every need, but it's the most qualified to make essential decisions for every American in every area. That mix of arrogance and audacity that guides the Obama administration is an affront to every freedom-loving American and a threat to every private sector job in this country.
Jonathan Martin, you've been out covering John Huntsman. Let's start there. Is he the one that Republicans have been waiting for?
Well, I'm struck, and I'm kind of chuckling at the contrast between John Huntsman, who says, I don't agree with President Obama, but you know, I don't think he's a bad American, and then Rick Perry, who's never going to say that, who's just going to tear into President Obama. I mean, this really shows, I think, the challenge that John Huntsman has. The Republican Party right now is dominated by a conservative base that can't stand President Obama and that wants somebody that's going to take it to him. And John Huntsman's diplomatic language, pun intended, may find support among some elites and a slice of the sort of moderate wing of the party. But I am not sure if it's going to find broader appeal. You know, his play, I think, is New Hampshire. This is a place where Democrats can participate in the primary, where unaffiliated voters can participate. If he can catch fire there with that sort of McCain 2000 coalition and rock it down in South Carolina with that momentum, then he may have a shot. But I think it's going to be awfully tough for him, given his background working for President Obama, his sort of civility language, and some of his apostasies where he deviates from conservative orthodoxy. You know, keep in mind, both President Bush and President Obama also issued a call to change the tone. They wanted to change Washington in some ways took on their own party in doing so. But both of them had attributes that more than compensated for those rhetorical touches. And Governor Huntsman, I'm not sure, has attributes that can sort of compensate for his own sort of civility-style campaign.
And as it's been pointed out repeatedly this week since the Huntsman announcement that that presidential campaigns passed are littered by the wayside with candidates who were trying to be nice guys on the campaign trail. Jack Beatty does.
Yeah.
What's the Huntsman effect on the current frontrunner, Mitt Romney?
I don't think there is one. I mean, he's not even in the polls, or he's 1% in the polls. I think Governor Huntsman did sort of recognize the key issue, downward mobility. That's unacceptable to Americans. He said that, and he said that rightly. On the other hand, you know, his distinguished resume and distinguished looks really have raised hopes about his campaign. And I think some people were disappointed that he favors a bad idea and what a former aide to John Boehner, writing in U.S. News, calls an insane idea. The bad idea is a flat tax. He introduced one as governor of Utah. Well, one study found that while the poorest 20% of the state residents paid 9% of their income under it, the richest 1% paid just 4.9%. And it also, of course, punched a big hole in Utah's budget. And the insane idea, again, this is according to a Republican columnist, is a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution that would require the government to spend no more than it collects in taxes. You know, Huntsman's balanced budget amendment would never probably balance the budget, but by crippling the government's ability to borrow to cushion slumps, it would convert recessions into depressions. So he distinguished looking, identified the main issue of the campaign, but a little disappointing, at least to some people, on his ideas.
I want to talk about Rick Perry in a minute, but one more question about Huntsman. You mentioned Utah, Jack. Jonathan Martin, will it cost Romney at the checkbook the Huntsman candidacy with two candidates popular among wealthy Mormons in Utah trying to win the GOP nomination? Will there be a dough split?
I think there will be competition for some of that Mormon money and some of the Utah money, but I think Romney will have an advantage in going after that. Of course, Huntsman's father is very wealthy, so there is family money there that Huntsman can tap into. But if I could just respond to Jack, too, I mean, I think Huntsman's challenge is that even before he gets to a conversation with voters about ideas and about, say, a balanced budget amendment, he has to make the case as to why somebody that worked for President Obama overseas and somebody who was loath to criticize his former boss should be the Republican nominee for president. I mean, he's gotten extensive media coverage for somebody who is lagging in the polls. But let's not mistake the sort of curiosity of media elites for the support of activist Republicans. I mean, we've seen this in cycles, and actually not just on the Republican side. You've seen it on the Democratic side. Invariably, there's a candidate who wants to get serious about the big problems facing the country and not pander and not get distracted by the issues that their party's base is obsessed with. And those candidates always get great glossy magazine treatment, all kinds of buzz. But, New York and Washington-based reporters and editors and pundits don't vote in party primaries in New Hampshire and Iowa. That's what matters.
Bill McKenzie, give us the view from Texas, the Lone Star State. What's the buzz on Rick Perry, Willie or Moni?
Well, before we go to Perry, I want to stand up here for Huntsman. Before we write him off, this, don't forget that George H.W. Bush had a very similar profile when he got in the race in 1980. And as I recall, he took the fight to Ronald Reagan all the way through April that year. So
he won
I think
Iowa.
There are still. Correct. So I don't think we should just write Huntsman off as a candidate who's only going to appeal to elites. I think what is going on here is we have a divide. Jonathan talked about the divide in foreign policy and Republicans. There's also a divide about the approach to domestic governance. And it's between those who believe in a limited but responsible government and those who believe in a minimalist government. The limited but responsible government is reflected more in the business-style Republicans that you would see that Huntsman would speak to and that are alive and well here in Texas that George W. Bush spoke to and brought into the into his campaign.
Well, who has the edge? Who has the edge at this point?
Well, certainly the minimalist slash Tea Party crowd would have the edge, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they will for sure nominate the next Republican presidential
right.
candidate. You know, there's a lot that can take place between now and then, including all those independents you all are talking about mm-hmm. up in New Hampshire and perhaps down in South Carolina. But to Rick Perry, is the one who speaks the language of the minimalist. He will go out and he'll trump what's going on with the Texas economy. But what he's going to have to explain is the fact that you have a number of business leaders in our state who are standing up to him for the policies he has taken and stands he's taken about our two flagship universities, A&M and University of Texas. He has gone after regents on the board, and he's trying to introduce a set of policies that a lot of business leaders say are going to impact the research base of these universities, and they're very concerned about that. You have to look at the fact that he is going to be talking about, well, we didn't use the rainy day fund, our emergency fund, to help balance the budget this time, and we didn't raise taxes. That's true. But by not using that rainy day fund, there are a number of education programs that business leaders in the state are standing up and saying, you know, this money for pre-K and other math-related programs is very important for our state. We should have used the rainy day fund. The governor doesn't have a whole lot of allies in the legislature here, so he's going to have to explain how he can take his style and apply that to Washington. Having said that, if I were Romney et al., I would not underestimate Rick Perry. This guy knows how to win elections. He has never lost a race going back to 1986. He really knows how to win.
All right, quick call from an On Point listener who wants to talk about John Huntsman. Edith is dialing us from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Edith.
Hi, Bob. I just want to say that I think it's very tragic that here we have, and by the way, I'm a lifelong liberal Democrat, so let me put that out there. I think it's very tragic that we have somebody like Huntsman who doesn't want to have a dirty campaign, who doesn't want to put down Obama, who wants to talk about the issues, and that this is not somebody that the pundits feel can have traction in the Republican Party. What does that say about the Republican Party? What does that say about the state of our elections? And I find this incredibly distressing because I do think it's going to be the ugliest, dirtiest campaign we've ever experienced.
Jack Beatty, weigh in here. We have about 30 seconds before the break.
You have to match the candidate with the mood. I think I'm not aware that the Democrats were really gentle on George W. Bush, even though they weren't running against him in 2008. They had to prove their bona fides in the primaries by really ripping him and his record. I certainly sympathize with Edith's general complaint, but it's a complaint about American politics generically, I think.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Northern Ireland's golf protege, Rory McIlroy, won his first major title at the U.S. Open.
To sit here at 22 years old, you know, as a major champion, it's a very nice feeling, and I'm sure it'll take a little bit of time to sink in, but, you know, it's just fantastic.
I'm sure it was. The Cleveland Cavaliers had the first pick in last night's NBA draft. Here's NBA Commissioner David Stern.
With the first pick in the 2011 NBA draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select Kyrie Irving from Duke University.
Open the checkbook, and Michelle Obama visits Africa on a goodwill tour with her daughters in tow. Here's a choir in Soweto, South Africa, singing tribute to the First Lady. You can join the conversation on the news of the week. What does the capture of Whitey Bulger, one of the 10 most wanted on the FBI's list, mean to you? Did you want to weigh in on the flooding and on Greece or on lady grunts in tennis? Here today with a great panel, Jonathan Martin of Politico, Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and On Point's Jack Beatty. Let's stay with politics and Washington for a while. Here's Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor walking out on budget talks yesterday after a disagreement with Democrats on tax revenue. House Speaker John Boehner explained why Republicans won't consider tax increases.
First of all, raising taxes is going to destroy jobs. And if you raise taxes on the people that we need to grow our economy and to hire new workers, guess what? They're not going to do it if they have to pay higher taxes to the federal government. Second, a tax hike cannot pass the U.S. House of Representatives. It's not just a bad idea. It doesn't have the votes, and it can't happen. And third, the American people don't want us to raise taxes.
Two top GOP leaders quitting the talks with Democrats aimed at finding agreement over raising the federal debt ceiling and cutting the federal budget. A moment ago, I said, here's Eric Cantor. Well, in fact, Eric Cantor, I don't believe has spoken publicly yet. He's left that to John Boehner. Bill McKenzie, what drove the breakdown?
Well, I think Speaker Boehner put his finger on it, that point number two, that a tax hike will not pass the Republican caucus in the House. And I think that's too bad. Clearly, we can't let this debt ceiling debate drive us into a ditch, and we're getting close to that point. All along, I've thought we're going to have a package that's going to deal not only with the $1.4 trillion deficit, but the larger $13 trillion debt, national debt, that's going to be about 75% spending cuts, which are or changes, where all, as we know, will deal mostly with entitlements, and about 25% would come from taxes. And here's the thing, and part of this is just all spin, and I guess it's how Republicans can sell it to themselves. If you have a tax overhaul that deals with all the different components of the tax code, and some parts and some of that change leads to some lower tax rates, but it also leads to more revenue coming into the Treasury. Could they not accept that as a way to deal with the tax part of these deficit/debt deals? I would hope they could.
Well,
and I'll say I've had conversations with Republicans up there who will privately acknowledge that they understand that that may be something that they may have to swallow.
Well, what's your guess? Do you think that anyone's going to blink or at least bend? Or are Democrats going to pull tax increases off the table? What's the likelihood Republicans will pull back on the very deep trillions in budget cuts?
Well, I don't know the answer. I only have a very strong hope is that both sides will come to their senses and that Democrats will have to do a lot more with entitlements than they're willing to do, and that Republicans, led perhaps by their business backers, recognize that we can't let the debt ceiling debate, as I said, create a greater fiscal anxiety, economic anxiety than we already have. And so I have a strong hope. I'm not in the Republican caucus to know exactly where the fault lines are, if there's some more wiggle room. But again, I will say I've talked to some senior Republicans up there, and I've been surprised what they would say privately. So the question is, how do you get them to do publicly what they'll acknowledge privately?
Jonathan Martin, your take.
Look, there was no way that Boehner and Kanter were ever going to support any deal that included a tax increase. For Republicans, you know, the possibility of a tax increase, going back to Bush 41's presidency when he raised taxes to get a balanced budget deal, has been anathema. So this, I think, in some ways was inevitable. The hope among Republicans is that this puts more pressure on President Obama and that he's going to have to cave on taxes. But he's going to face huge pressure from his own political base in the House and Senate, his own party in the House and Senate, that are already restive. But look, I mean, I think this is a recipe for more gridlock, more of a delay. My colleague David Rogers, who's been covering spending and budget issues on Capitol Hill for 30 years, has a good story today on Politico, and he said that this probably means that this debate will go now beyond the August recess.
All right, let's talk to some On Point listeners lining up waiting to talk about this issue. Tom is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Bob. I consider rising interest rates on our debt to be as much, if not more so, of a tax hike, tax increase, as Grover Norquist's opposition to eliminating ethanol subsidy. And despite some on the far right who are saying the debt ceiling doesn't really matter, it's going to increase not just what the government pays on interest, but also our credit cards and adjustable mortgages. That's a tax increase. The more money going to pay interest on our debt is less money that's going into our schools, our military, roads, anything else. So when they come out saying, the Republicans, we're not going to be for a tax hike, you don't raise the national ceiling, debt ceiling, you have just voted for a tax hike.
Jack Beatty, I hear what Tom is saying, but the fact of the matter is that interest rates in the U.S. are quite low right now. And in fact, the Fed is signaling just this week that they're going to remain low for some time. So is there political cost right now to this strategy, if it is a strategy, by the GOP on these talks?
Well, first, to Tom's point, as I understand it, should there be a default, the first in our history, that would immediately raise interest rates. Because, of course, suddenly we become a risky proposition for anybody to give money to the United, lend money to the United States. Although rates are very low now, they could immediately, that could change directly, default happens. Second, on the politics, it is so, dangerous politically for the Republicans to essentially say, we will put the United States into default with all this pain and no Social Security checks, no paying of the troops and so on, to protect subsidies for oil companies, to protect tax loopholes for companies that ship jobs overseas, to protect all these tax expenditures and these earmarks in the tax code. As I understand it, the Democrats, most of them aren't talking about increases in tax rates, but as Bill says, they're talking about tax reform that would in aggregate increase revenue for the government. And in that sense, increase taxes, but not individual taxes, corporate taxes and oil company taxes. And so if the Republicans really say we're going to go into default over protecting oil companies, boy, that is just poison, it seems to me.
Jerry's calling from Boston. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Bob. I think, in my own suggestion, it's time the Democratic Party called the Republican bluff. Because whenever you listen to the Speaker of the House, Boehner, speak, it's like he's giving the national ultimatum and saying it's not what America wants. What America is talking about? It's a simple calculation that if you want to get more money, is either you lower your cost and raise, how to get money. So the combination of, raising tax for the rich, wealthy people, and then reducing the spending is the way to go. So let the Democrat Party for once call the Republican bluff and see what's going to happen. Thank you, Bob.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. Bill McKenzie, weigh in on this. Do you think Republicans are bluffing? And if so, do you think Democrats will call the bluff?
Well, I think this move by Kanter is probably a great relief to Democrats because the spotlight is off of them now. And I think, and I agree to 99% of what Jack just said, but you know what? Democrats are probably quite relieved that they're not going to have to now start making some of these hard choices on entitlements. And so far, they have not wanted to make those choices on things like Medicare and Social Security. And those are going to be equally tough for Democrats to make, as equally tough as it is for Republicans to make some of these tax calls. And so far, the spotlight has only been on Republicans, and everybody's beating up on the Republicans for pulling out of these talks. And I, too, don't want them to pull out of the talks for reasons I just cited. But let's not be naive here. The Democrats are going to have a very difficult time coming up with a set of entitlement reforms that they're going to be comfortable with. They want to pound on defense spending, and that's kind of it. And these entitlement things are going to be difficult things to sell to their caucus.
Let's talk economy. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Bill, especially after they have road tested up in the New York 26, the political potency of Medicare.
Right.
They don't want to have the blood on their hands of cutting Medicare after they've found what they think is a winning issue.
Let's talk economy for a couple of minutes here. On Wednesday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave his second news conference ever. He said the U.S. was settling into a frustratingly slow economic recovery.
Consumers' purchasing power has been damped by higher food and energy prices, and the aftermath of the tragic earthquake and tsunami in Japan has been associated with disruptions in global supply chains, especially in the auto sector.
All right. The Federal Reserve downgraded its forecast for economic growth without extending its stimulus plans. Stocks fell overnight. Jonathan Martin, does the state of the economy continue to be the number one Achilles heel for President Obama in 2012?
Absolutely. If you just look at political history, it's been decades since a president was able to manage re-election with this high of a level of unemployment. In fact, if you just go back to when the Bureau of Labor Statistics began keeping these kind of records under President Truman, there's not been a president that got reelected with this kind of unemployment level. So it's going to be his central challenge. He's got to make the case that there's improvements, that we're just about to turn the corner. And that's what Reagan had in 84. There was months of progress. Obama has got to start seeing those numbers really turn around so he can make that case. There's internal debate right now within the White House and within the Democratic Party as to how you go about messaging this, because we've gotten to a point now where a lot of Democrats, including David Axelrod, the president's top political advisor, don't think that you can keep blaming President Bush. So they're taking responsibility for the economy, but they don't want to do too much happy talk about the progress that's being made, because they don't want to appear insensitive to a lot of folks who are still looking for work. So they're in a real tough bind right now. And I think if you're a Republican, you're seeing President Obama, who otherwise is going to be a formidable opponent like most incumbents are, this could be the real way to go after President Obama on a pure economic message that things have not gotten better under his tenure.
Walmart. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a sex discrimination suit against Walmart on behalf of 1.6 million female employees. Brad Seligman, attorney for the women, said the ruling was a blow to all workers.
We're certainly disappointed in the decision. It erects substantial barriers for women, or frankly any group, to bring cases together collectively to challenge illegal conduct.
Bill McKenzie, why do you guess the Supreme Court rejected this case?
Well, I think they rejected because the plaintiffs couldn't show that there was a common claim among a class of people, 1.5 million people. And I read the decision by the court, and I think it was right on both counts. One is that in the split 5-4 verdict that the majority didn't think that the claim was common enough. And then all nine justices said, hey, the plaintiffs used a part of the rules of procedure to drive this class action suit through, and you used it in a way that was not applicable. Both those decisions send a signal to class action suits, which, there are quite a few of them around the country, and trial lawyers are very good at trying to stitch these things together to say you're going to have to be very specific and narrow when you go about these things. And I think that's a good thing in a society that is overly litigious.
So will this be a chiller? Will workers be more reluctant to file suits? Will lawyers be less likely to sign on to these suits?
Well, I think that this – use our terms right here. I think that it will mean that trial lawyers will be less likely to be able to stitch some of these things together without a very specific set of claims. And I would hope that the workers who have been – who have feel like they have a very good case to bring against a company like Walmart can get together with a more limited class action suit and press that. I have no problem with that. But I think it's the when they're trying to put together a million and a half people and say, hey, look, here's a common claim we have against a company, I think that they just couldn't make that case. And while everybody is focused on Walmart as the big power, let's not forget that the trial lawyers are a big power in our society, too.
All right, one last story before we sign off. After 16 years on the lam, the FBI this week arrested one of its 10 most wanted, longtime crime boss in Boston, James Bulger, known as Whitey Bulger. He was picked up in Santa Monica, California, where he'd been living in one apartment building under the radar for most of that time, only a few miles from the L.A. office of the FBI. He's accused of 19 murders and of racketeering and extortion in the Boston area and will face charges in other states and could be in the line for the death penalty in at least one of those cases. This morning, I spoke with Lou Ann Liddiff, the daughter of one of Bulger's victims. She discussed what she wants from Bulger now that he's in custody.
I want him to own it, to admit to everything, what he did. I want him to apologize, not that he will. I want him to have his day in court and bring down the people who are walking around free and clear blaming him for everything. He had associates. He had people helping him. There's no way this man did these things alone. And these people with their little book deals and their deals with the government, it's disgusting.
Jack Beatty, describe how big a deal this is in Boston, how big a deal this arrest is.
Well, along with Charlie on the MTA, who was an old Kingston Trio refrain about will he ever return, will he ever return, his fate is still unknown. You know, he's been the Charlie of this generation of Bostonians. People joke about him. Where did such and so, Whitey's got it. Whitey. But you know, this legend about him, it gets away from that. He's a vicious killer.
But he's now behind bars, and he has already appeared in a California federal courtroom after his arrest there. He's due back in Boston soon, and we'll see where this case goes from here. Jack Beatty, thanks very much. Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, thank you. Jonathan Martin, senior political reporter for Politico, thank you. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.